Hello, everybody, and welcome back to this series of interviews on Grip Media with candidates who are seeking your vote in the European elections of 2024, which will be held, as we all know it by now, on June the 7th. If you are not registered, it's now too late by the time this has gone out. So sorry about that. Maybe next time. But that said, if you are registered and you do have a vote, we're here to introduce you to another candidate. This time we're leaving Ireland Northwest, where we spent the first of this series of interviews, and we're going all the way down to the south of the country to the Ireland South constituency, which will also be electing five MEPs. Now, one candidate who's entered the race here as an independent is perhaps somebody who you don't see that often on RTE or Virgin Media. Her name is Mary Fitzgibbon, and she joins me today. Mary, how are you?
I'm very good, and it's great to be on this chat with you, John.
Well, thank you very much. I'll start with the question I ask every single candidate. There's I think 23 candidates running in Ireland South. Why should people vote for you and not any of the other 22?
Okay, number one, I'm running as an independent. So that means that I serve you, not any party, I serve you. And I promise to do everything in my power to serve you in Europe. I really feel that we have lost a lot of our sovereignty. We've ceded a lot of control to Europe. So for us to regain that, we have to align with very like-minded politicians in the European Parliament who, you know, there are many thinking like us, who want to make policies or to have laws that actually are in the best interests of our country. And I know that I think I'm the only nurse and midwife and lecturer in nursing running in this election. I think I'm the only Mary as well. So, and I'm only one of two female independent candidates in the South. So all I can say is I've been with people on their arrival into the world. I've been with people at the end of their lives. And nurses have a lot of regard in this country. They have are seen as people with integrity. So all I will say to you is that for 36 years, I have been in a caring profession. I have been teaching for an awful lot, long time, and I will serve you with, you know, every bone in my body. I will work night and day for the people who would elect me. Nothing to do with anything to do with parties, just you.
I've asked this question to everybody as well. I'm going to ask it to you as well, because I think it's important for people to know. If you happen to get elected on June the 7th, who will you be sitting with in the European Parliament? I mean, because I think you say you're independent, which is fine. Lots of people are running as independents, but the European Parliament doesn't really have a strong independent caucus.
That's
to get anything done, you have to join a group and work with people. So who will it be?
Okay, so there's seven political groupings and you have to align with one of them. And the two that I've looked at are Identity and Democracy and the Conservative Reformers. I think either of those, I'm sure, you know, if elected, they set out their stall, but I have looked at their policies. And given that my platform is really around sovereignty, immigration, neutrality, family life, agriculture and small business, I think, you know, they have policies that are definitely in support of those things. They are seeing that Europe isn't serving member states, and it has become the power has become far too centralized. I thought it was interesting. Another independent Ireland Now, you changed, said in a committee hearing when he was asked who really runs Europe, that Timmermans told the EPP, which is the biggest grouping in the parliament, that if you don't vote for the nature restoration law, you won't get through your agenda. It was in a committee hearing with Michael Fitzmaurice asking the question. So I certainly would be aligning with either of those two parties that are certainly pro-family, pro-natalist and pro-sovereignty.
Right. Well, I'm going to ask you a question now, and I just have to put this to you, because I'm sitting here, I'm reading the Irish Times today. Pat Leahy, who is their senior political, is their political editor, in fact, very sharp observer of politics. And he says something today in a piece which I think a lot of people might agree with. I'll read it to you. He says, with European elections throwing up surprises and an electorate which has become increasingly volatile, late swings of support in the election campaign can be expected. But for now, the data suggests that whatever support there is for anti-migration candidates, it is scattered among too many candidates to give any of them sufficient momentum to challenge for a seat. Many, and these are his words, anti-migrant or far-right candidates are attracting just 1 or 2% support, with many showing at less than 1%, the polls show. This refers to the poll in the Irish Times. That poll, Mary, shows you on 1%. And like there'll be people listening to this. One of the criticisms we keep getting in, not of you, I should be said, and it's not a criticism of you directly, but of a lot of candidates who are running, is there are loads of people running who, I mean, if I go down to the bookmakers tomorrow and I ask for odds on you getting elected, they're very short. Sorry, they're very long. They just don't think it's going to happen. So, I mean, obviously you have a right to seek election, but aren't there just too many people running on this platform that you're talking about? Every candidate I've interviewed has said, I want to join your Identity and Democracy or the European Conservatives and Reformists. It's like, and you're all competing for this same vote. So, I mean, is that not a strategic error?
I actually think it's a wonderful thing that there are so many candidates running. I know what, you know, the narrative that the Irish Times create, and you know, they want to demoralize us as independents. But I really think for a change that the Irish people are beginning to really wake up and see, you know, see what's really going on here. When you think about it, the electorate that's in 10 counties, and there's only 23 people putting themselves forward. Yeah, I know I'm my odds aren't good on the bookies. And I'm like, I said to my husband, I'm the dark horse. And he says, yeah, you're a bit of an egg, all right. But I think it's such a courageous thing that somebody would put their names forward and would try and enter into this race. And we have to really, I don't have a quarter of a million. It's what they, those who have been elected previously can spend. And we know that money can buy elections. But look, thankfully, there are platforms such as Gripped, and, you know, we can use Elon Musk's X to get our message out there. And hopefully it resonates. But it also empowers people that, yeah, I can go with confidence to vote for the candidate that I feel best represents me. And I, even if, you know, it doesn't translate, and we've had these big discussions about, you know, our first preferences and running down the ballot paper and using them all, I actually think that I would only vote for those who I feel that serve my interests or serve the interests of the country. I've seen that narrative, but I was looking at what Eddie Punch was saying too, and I just think it's there to demoralise us. And look, we don't know. I was listening at the town hall event. Dr. Teresa Reedy said that the last three seats in our five-seat constituency were up for grabs, really. We don't know where the results are going to go. You have really a lot of really angry people out there that are fed up with the way things are going. There are people who want to see radical change, and they want to maybe hammer the parties. So look, I think it's up for grabs. I know I'm looking at, she was trying to say there were safe seats, but if you go down through the comments, I know the Twitter world isn't representative, but a lot of people who are actually invested in politics do enter into debate. They are not, they are really, the comments that they're making under the mainstream, you know, your Fianna Fáil and your Fine Gael, it doesn't bode well for them. And look, an opportunity in a lifetime.
Well, there's a lot of people out there. Of course, I often say that living in a democracy is a bit like living in the tyranny of the uninformed voter. And there's a lot of voters out there who maybe aren't paying that much attention. So if any of them happen to be listening, you talk about radical change. How do you enact radical change in Europe as an independent? You go in there day one. What's priority number one for Mary Fitzgibbon? You might get one piece of legislation through in 5 years if you work really hard. What would that piece of legislation?
Well, currently you can't initiate legislation within the Parliament, but certainly you can make amendments and you can, you know, vote to reject it. But again, you're talking about groupings. But it was interesting. I can't recall the exact name now, but one of the last contributions in the European Parliament said that things were going to change. They are moving. And I, you know, this term far right, I think right so far is a far better term, because the immigration issue, that I'm seeing that and housing as the two main issues. And it's not just Ireland. It's across Europe. So if you are getting, and some of the polls are showing a huge swing towards this anti-immigration stance. So if you go into the European Parliament, and okay, you have to align with the grouping, but if they get additional people, and say the European People's Party doesn't hold sway in the next Parliament, say they don't elect Ursula, then you have clout. But there's also moves, they said, to allow legislation to be initiated. But I mean, John, this comes back to the debates we had around the Nice and the Lisbon Treaty. And I was against those because I could see the power grab for what the whole EU project was. And that's why there, you know, there's this whole disenfranchised section of society who feels that the control is centralized, the commission is holding the control. So, I mean, maybe breaking that up somewhat by shifting alignments within the European Parliament is a start. And it remains to be seen. June 7th is a pivotal moment across Europe. Look, that's what we can. We always hold on to hope that we can initiate or bring about political change.
But like you say that, but what kind of political change? Like, give me some examples of what's happening in Europe right now that you think Europe could be doing something different.
Well, look at the EU Migration and Asylum Pact. I mean, there was the vote on that, but Ireland and Denmark opted out of that. And we have a government intent on pushing that through.
I think what you mean is Ireland and Denmark have the right to opt out.
Yes, we have. Yeah. And we fought long and hard for those opt-outs. So we have to hold a government here to account, not to just go along with what, the rest of the member states are going along with. It doesn't serve our interests. I mean, certainly we're looking at our the GDP coming into play here. And we don't even know how many migrants. I mean, we're on course to get 30,000 this year. I wrote an email to all of the politicians just during the week about, is there any potential correlation between the increased payment in January to the numbers that are flooding in here, given some of the comments I have read in the mainstream press, actually, about how welcoming Ireland is. But just number one, we could certainly work on that EU migration pact, because I think really it should be back to every country their own decisions around these issues. And another one was the nature restoration law. That's really, I went to two IFA meetings, one in Fermoy and one in Kenny, and I could tell you, I think that the farmers see now they're waking up and feeling they've been sold a pup in their farm. The family farm is under huge threat. It's not financially viable unless you have a massive, massive farm. There are huge issues. So maybe we could get moves on that again. Just because if there's enough momentum. But again, the commission has an awful lot of control. And that's I think there's possibilities because listening to a lot of European Parliament members, I mean, they're speaking the same language as us. And if we can unify, you could create a lot of momentum for getting legislative change.
Okay, well, there's all this business of farming, which you've mentioned. I mean, and you talked about the small family farm surviving. Should it survive? If you look at and I'm playing devil's advocate here, I'm not reflecting my own views necessarily, but I'm asking you as a candidate, a lot of your opponents in Brussels will say the average size of the Irish family farm is 33 hectares. In the UK, it's more than double that, 76. And we know in the world that we live in with economics, economies of scale and everything work to the benefit of larger holdings. And Ireland is one of the few countries in Europe where you have this little patchwork of very small little farms all duplicating the same work over and over again. I mean, in the long term, is there not an argument that the small family farm just isn't viable? And if it isn't viable without massive European subsidies that you want to defend, I mean, defending that?
Well, I suppose there's two issues going on. And one of them is the demographics and the family farm. And I brought this up at the meetings. We have to look at our population and our total fertility rate. The Telegraph, they said we're 1.54. We have been below replacement level since 1999. So if you're talking to family, they agreed with me in the meetings, we're not having children. You're lucky to see one or two children. Women are around 32 when they're having their first child now, and they'll be lucky to have a second. Given the figures that we have. So the family farm is under threat from a declining population. And if they do have a son or a daughter and it's not sustainable, an awful lot of them are emigrating. If they're educated and emigrating, they're leaving. So the family farm is under threat from that side. And also, yeah, I believe small is beautiful. The people in this country did not have the ability to own land for centuries. For centuries. And then through various, the Land League and so on, and even just getting our vote back, the land means an awful lot to us. You know, the land is really, really, I think of the field by John B. Keane, and you think how much the land means to us. And the people that have walked that land and worked that land, it means an awful lot to them. So I don't believe in this corporatism. They actually brought up about large tracts of land, particularly in Fermanagh, being bought up. And I think this is something we have to be concerned about, that we don't allow the corporations to have control of food security. I mean, if you have a couple of acres and you can plant spuds, you can feed a heck of a lot of people. I mean, we moved out to the country. My husband restored a cottage, and I used to say it was the 20-year project, but we moved out to the country because we wanted to have land. We don't have a lot, but we wanted to be able to grow our own. And I really think that you think about the old farming system we had, each family was sort of self-sustaining. And I think this, this large scale farming is something that creates its own problems. So on the one hand, I believe small is beautiful, and I think we should do everything to support farmers who want to stay in farm and who want to produce. We have the best food in the world here in Ireland. We have the most fabulous land. I've driven across gone from the Skelligs up to Newtown Mount Kennedy, as it was, and across the Sally Gap. We have fabulous land here, and we can produce fabulous food. But and I mean, the organic movement is there as well. And you go to the farmers markets, let's bring back to low. Like, look, in America, you have Bill Gates has bought up huge tracts of land. You've got Monsanto owning the seeds, doing genetic modification, not so that we can't grow our own. It's very, very important that
would you ban genetic modification of food?
Well, there are certain elements to genetic modification that have benefits. You can't just say, oh, forget all of that. But when you get a thing where I always am looking to say seedless, we always had the way to be able to grow food from fruit and from vegetables and things like that. So I wouldn't like to see a thing where you have modification where it's benefiting the big multinationals. That's something we have to be like in the morning. We have only a 3-day turnaround in our supermarkets, and we saw the panic when 2020 we got the COVID. They I don't know, there was a run on toilet paper, but certainly there was a run on food.
Okay,
we need to be encouraging our own self-sufficiency.
All right. Well, look, I want to move on because I think your views are clear on that. I want to talk about something that's kind of almost unique to you as a candidate, and you've mentioned it a couple of times so far in this interview, and I haven't really heard many other candidates talk about it, which is this business of demographics and being pronatalist and basically people not having enough babies. What can you do about that practically? I mean, you can't basically go around to 20-something-year-old woman and say, thou must have a child. I mean, what can you do?
I think it's almost innate in us to want to have a family. And I think it's the most beautiful thing to have, to be able to have a child. And I know so many people that haven't been able to have a child. So I see children as a gift, and I also uphold the right to life of a child in the womb. And there are many ways you can support the family. We haven't, our maternity leave is bad, but the government decided through various policies. I had a friend who worked in all of this area, and she said they had a choice. They had a choice to either give women the option to stay at home and mind their children, do a bit of part-time work or be in their careers, or get women out to work and contribute to the GDP. And like, tax individualization was one of those sort of watershed moments where For example, me, where my husband is at home and I am working, we are penalised as a family. I only have five children. I would have loved to have had five more. I think children are absolutely amazing. I met a friend of mine the other day. They had difficulty having children. And he said, you know, I'm getting older now and I wish we had more children. So there is a lot of regret. A lot of people would love to have more children, but the economics don't play. And when you had in 2018 a situation where the right to life of the child in the womb was removed from the Irish Constitution, and they legislated to have abortion, basically taxpayer funded. Now we have 10,000 babies that aren't being born every year. And I started teaching maternity in Ireland back in 1998, and we had something like 79,000, 80,000 births. Now we're lucky if we have about 54,000 births, and 25% of those births are not to Irish people. So we have to have really mature conversations around that. You can have all these tax incentives. They haven't increased the child benefit for 13 years. I could nearly scream. I wrote to Michael McGrath, because my children decided to go to college in across the water, not because the colleges were for their area of interest. I asked him, was there any tax relief for me in terms of my support of them? I didn't even get a reply from him. And I got a reply from, I think it was Simon Harris at the time, that said he passed it on to Michael McGrath. But like, we're really, I feel I'm part of this paying class, and I don't get any, and also like this also, I'm is servicing an awful lot of industries. For example, I'm paying the music teacher. I'm paying for the sports. I'm paying for, you know, if they want to, they're in the guides and scouts and they're going on the camps. So my income helps so many other people. But, you know, they don't even think that we should be getting child benefit because, oh, that's a parent's payment. Why should we be giving it to the parents? They don't trust us that we'd know what to do with this in the interests of our children. So you could reduce, you know, tax reliefs. Look at Hungary. I mean, they have tried to turn around their demographic implosion. And I know still Ireland is very, very family orientated. And I think it supports longer maternity leave, much more flexibility. An investment in family life is what we need to see.
What about the rest of us? What about people like me, who my wife, who don't sadly have children? We're paying through the nose in taxes to support the rest of you who do already. I mean, so and it sounds to me that you would like to tax us more. And I mean, is that a reality? Is there a case for that?
No, I didn't say we'd tax anyone anymore, but I would certainly say that if you can create an urgency around the fact that we are below replacement level, and if you look at countries like South Korea, that is going to have an impact later on in terms of pensions and in terms of the burden on society. Of course, now, if I remember Valerie Giscard d'Estaing said that once you got to 65, well, you weren't really contributing to the GDP anymore. And he would have been a euthanasia advocate. So I can see that coming down the tracks for the elderly. To try and offset the burdens. But I think there has to be a fairness. There has to be a commitment to family life. There has to be a commitment to the fact that a country needs children. We need population. And look, the ins and outs of how you work that out in terms of fairness. But it certainly, if you have one at home, the tax individualization is one place where they could start. And they could certainly increase the child benefit in line with inflation.
Okay, but I agree with a lot of what you've said, for the record, but there's one contradiction, I think, in and it's not just a contradiction in your platform, it's a contradiction in a platform of a lot of people, because there's always been this sort of connection between people who are pro-natalist on the one hand and people who are running on the immigration issue on the other hand. And isn't the reality, Mary, that if you could wave a wand tomorrow and introduce a whole raft of pro-natalist policies and people from today started having more children, say we could double the birth rate from next year moving on, be 25 years before those children with modern education actually reach the stage where they're paying taxes, contributing to society. And in the meantime, we've reached the point where it's actually too late to avoid a demographic bombshell. because the pension, the bulge in the pension system is moving so that this crisis is going to hit us in 10, 15 years. So, I mean, don't you actually need substantial immigration right now, regardless of whether you enact pronatalism or not?
One of the issues we have is emigration. If you look at the demographic of Irish people that are leaving this country, they are the ones that would, be thinking about, trying to buy a house and having a family. I've been teaching nurses for 28 years, and I've noticed now that it's not a question of even wanting to travel. It's a question of we have to go. So if you were to reverse the trend and make it viable for our able to, housing is.
Sorry, Mary, we lost your audio just there for a second. So if you want to just repeat what you said a second ago.
Sorry. If we, one of the things is the demographic that of Irish people that are leaving this country are those that would want to think about buying a house maybe and starting a family. So if we can reverse that trend. So I've seen a few of your articles about the numbers leaving and the visas for Australia. I see that my student nurses now are not even talking about wanting to travel, but feeling they have to go, that there isn't anything. And then I'm reading articles in the paper with students that I actually educated in Australia saying they'd love to come back. But number one, they couldn't find some place to rent. They couldn't afford something to buy. And the health service is chaotic. So I have ideas around how do we keep our, I don't want to impose. I think travel is wonderful. But for those who want to stay in Ireland, the incentives that there are there so that those people who would like to stay in Ireland and settle down and to start having children and a family, that could be done. We have a golden opportunity. You know, when one group of nurses graduate, we could incentivize them to even stay for 1 year to staff our hospitals. And then you'd have the next group coming out. So like I'm never one for imposing, reducing choice or restricting choice, because I think travel is a wonderful thing. But what you've got now is a forced immigration. And it's interesting, I was reading in 1972, the big issues for Ireland when they were considering joining the European Economic Community, as it was there, were agriculture and emigration. Now, you turn that around in 50 years, what are the two big issues? There's emigration of our young Irish educated, immigration of all of these, what's going on, economic migrants, illegal immigration. And you have agriculture, the farmers absolutely disgruntled, really feeling disaffected and being blamed for environmental changes and climate changes and all of that kind of thing.
Okay.
So I do think there are so many things we could do for the demographic. I was really sad to see a couple had come back to Ireland and then 3 or 4 years later, they're up and leaving again, having had their third child, leaving Ireland. And Australia is so far away. And, for me, I can't see that any of my 5 children are going to be in the country at the rate we're going. So these are mature conversations we need, really, really.
Okay. I want to finish the interview with a couple of questions on foreign policy, which is what I've been asking everybody. So I'll start and we'll try and keep these quick. Is the government correct in seeking to recognise an independent state of Palestine?
I think that all nationalities, and if you think about our own situation in Ireland, we wanted recognition of our sovereignty and we wanted recognition of our state. So that's certainly, that is an area that needs recognition. But it's a quite complex thing when you have people living side by side that really don't see eye to eye. And now we've seen it in the north, that they have, we have come to peace agreements there. So look, nothing is impossible. But all I will say is on neutrality, we want to be, we are a neutral country and we should be at the forefront of efforts for peace. I absolutely abhor war. I don't want to see any innocent civilian die. And it's harrowing what's happening across Europe, across the Middle East. And we need to be a front and center in relation to efforts to bring about peace.
Well, on that, Ireland may well be a neutral country, and indeed militarily neutral we are, but the European Union is obviously has a common foreign policy. Part of
That's
that
it.
common foreign policy is that last year, or indeed early this year, the latest package of military aid to Ukraine was passed through the European Parliament, some 50 billion being directed there. The
Yes.
Ukrainians obviously say they're under huge pressure on two fronts from the Russians. They need that to save their own people's lives from Russian advancing armies, and if they don't have it, the Russians will win that war. If there is another, if you're elected and another round of aid comes up, and the Ukrainians say they need another 50 billion to keep going, will you be voting for that or against it?
I'd be voting against it.
Does
And
that?
you know, look, the thing with Ukraine, the war in Ukraine has been going on since 2014. It just didn't happen overnight. I have friends, two friends from the Donbass. I helped them to get asylum back in 2005. It's a very complex situation, and and the other thing is, I went to an exhibition in our library of young Ukrainians who have died in the war. And they don't have a, de like us, they don't have a demographic of young people. And now they're going around and they are arresting. I don't know what the, I saw a video of somebody being arrested to be put onto the front lines. We have, Russia lost 40% of its men in World War II. We have to broker peace. We have to stop the war machine. We need to become the peace machine. All of these, the arms industry makes so much money out of all of this misery and mayhem and destruction. We've got to stop and find other ways to bring about and broker peace.
But let's
And
say,
we're a net contributor now to the European Union. So our money, where is our money going? And then some of the comments from our political leaders have been very inflammatory. So we have to think, we have to have those conversations around neutrality as well. We have to have those conversations because the pen is mightier than the sword and war.
I asked this question to Pat or Toby, and I'll ask it to you as well, because you're saying there be a voice for peace in the world, and all that sort of stuff. Unfortunately, the whole world doesn't agree. The president of Russia has been quite bellicose for some time. Let's say that the war in Ukraine ends with a Russian victory, and the Russians decide that they then want to take back the Baltic states, which of course they have a historical claim on, or part of the Soviet Union for most of the last century. They're obviously EU members. In circumstances where there was a Russian conflict with a Baltic member, a Baltic state, does Ireland or indeed the European Union have any obligation to come to the aid of an EU member against aggression, whether it be from Russia or anybody else?
Well, in terms of we're not a member of NATO, so a lot of those European countries are members of NATO, so they will obviously naturally be, there will be, NATO will come to their assistance. In terms of us here being part of the European Union, neutrality is one of our central planks, and that was debated long and hard with the Lisbon Treaty. So to us to become involved militarily, no, I don't agree. I don't agree. And I know people in the defense forces, and they certainly don't want to be fighting a war. Like I want to, we can stop, we can bring about an end to war. I'm no doubt that if there were collective efforts to bring about peace, it would happen. We have to have, we have to learn from the past. You know, I this bloodshed, this loss of life of young people. I go, you know, I've been over to the graveyards in France, and you see millions and millions of young people. One inscription was, it said, to the world he was one, but to us he was the whole world. I mean, what was it all for? All this loss of life. Surely to God we can bring about peace and not put an end to killing innocent people, innocent civilians, and you know, forcing young people out to war. I certainly don't want my sons fighting in a war. I don't think any other mother in Ireland wants their sons fighting in a war. Especially when there's so much money tied up in the arms industry.
Okay. So, all right, well, Mary, we have to leave it there because we're out of time. But it's been a pleasure chatting to you and getting to hear about your platform. And I'll say to you what I say to every candidate in this series, which is thank you for taking the very brave step of putting your name on a ballot paper. There would be no democracy and no choice without people willing to stand up and make their arguments. To you, the listeners, thank you for listening to Mary. Thank you for listening to her perspective. She is running in Ireland South, along with a whole range of other independents. I'd list them all, but we'd be here till next Tuesday, frankly, if we tried that. We'll be talking to some more of them later on in the week. Next up will be an interview with somebody else who's running in her constituency, which is Mr. Derek Bligh. We'll be hearing from him in the middle of the week. And until then, it's goodbye from me, and make sure and vote on June 7th.